Hey, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. Today we're going to be talking to Dr. Dennis Paulson. He was awarded his PhD in zoology by the University of Miami in 1966 and has been an influential figure in birding in the Pacific Northwest since 1987. He's a retired director of the Slater Museum of Natural History at the University of Puget Sound and author of the loved and admired Shorebirds of the Pacific Northwest, among many other books. He taught the Seattle Audubon Master Birding Class for many years and has talked at just about every local and regional birding-related event for decades. So why birds? Here's what Audubon says. Climate change is by far the biggest threat to the birds that we love. That's why Audubon works for solutions to counteract the effects of climate change and achieve net zero emissions by 2050. We are very privileged to be talking with this brilliant and much admired expert, so here we go. We're pleased to have Dennis Paulson with us today. Dennis, welcome to Climate Talk.
My pleasure.
So we have an expression in our culture, the canary in the coal mine. And of course, the story is basically back in the olden days, the miners deep down in the coal mines would have a canary in a cage. And if the canary had problems, then that was an indication there was the air was going bad and the miners need to get out of there. And I was just thinking, probably a good deal for the miners, bad deal for the canary. But
for sure. I don't know. I don't remember if they took the canary out with them when they
took the mine. Yeah, it's like,
I hope they did.
See you on the top. Yeah. So do you think that that's an appropriate kind of metaphor? There is an important lesson in there. And larger question than that is, what are birds in general telling us about our environment, and in particular, if climate change is an aspect of what they're telling us?
Sure. Well, first of all, we have very, very many canaries now, as I'm sure you've learned. So many birds all over the world declining, some of them dramatically, some of them slowly. It's a very good thing that we've had censuses developed over the years to monitor these bird populations. In North America, we have the Christmas Bird Count, which has been going on for over 100 years, which tells us what populations are like in the middle of the winter. We have the Breeding Bird Survey that's been going on, I think, since the 1960s, which also very tremendous effort by amateur birders all over the country, all over North America, really, and to just basically to census these birds. So we have all this quantitative data. And of course, those data are what allowed people to say a couple of years ago of how much bird populations are declining in North America. It's astonishing, the numbers. And here I am living in Seattle. I've lived in Seattle for 52 years now. I came here from Florida, so I have some knowledge of Florida as well. And I've been following sort of what goes on elsewhere in the country and the world. And so I've actually given presentations on the status of birds in Washington State. Some are declining, some are increasing, some are stable, and it's very interesting to try to understand why. And climate change plays a part. I don't think it's played anywhere nearly as important a part as so many other variables, like food availability, habitat availability, those sorts of things. But I think we're seeing some indication of it. I think the only indication we've seen of it in some ways is positive, as several species expanding to the north and becoming more and more common in Washington, Anna's hummingbirds, California scrub jays, black phoebes, these southern species, which occurred in Oregon and became more common there and then penetrated Washington and now occur even in southern British Columbia in small numbers.
So those my father was an English teacher, and he liked to quote from a poem that said something like, "'Tis an ill wind that blows no man good." And what the idea being is that even when something bad happens, some people, some aspects are going to have an improved situation. So I think what you just pointed out there is that environmental change and climate change and related, it's not a one-way street. I mean, there are pluses and minuses. And so you're pointing out expanded habitats for some birds. So do we find that there are some species that are better at doing that than others?
Yeah, and actually I guess you said expanded habitats, and I suppose that's an important term, because that expanded habitat, of course, is the human environment. The birds that are, especially, well, the hummingbird and the jay, not necessarily the phoebe, but are definitely taking advantage of people, of feeders all winter, of planted horticultural plants that support these particular kinds of birds. So we have changed the environment and allowed them to benefit perhaps from warmer winters. Not that it's that warm this winter. There's a lot of variability, and these birds, of course, live only a few years, so they really feel that variability. Even though climate change has made an area overall warmer, there may be a couple of really cold years that actually diminish the populations of some of these birds. And then as the change keeps going on, you know, they will increase again. There's been a lot of work on butterflies in Europe showing how many butterflies and even dragonflies, which I study, have expanded their ranges northward because of warmer summers and warmer situations generally. And at the same time, we have a lot of good data on bog dwelling and cold habitat dwelling dragonflies declining. So there's a sort of push and pull of it. Some species are declining, that are the northern species are declining, the southern ones are increasing. And with things like plants, which can't fly around like these birds and butterflies and dragonflies, it's a much slower process, but it seems to be happening as well.
Yeah, well, my understanding is that, to that point specifically, that there are some species of plants that can migrate with the changing climate, and others are left behind, especially, like, let's say, trees that exist in an alpine area. That's where they live, and they can't move in the valley and up the next mountain. And you, as you point out, birds have got a huge advantage in being able to move as the climate and the environment changes.
That's for sure. Yeah, and that's one of the things that's made them such a good steady organism for climate change and for just everything, really, because they're very adaptable. They adapt to changing conditions. In Washington State, we have a tremendous number of birds that have increased in recent years for various reasons. Some of them, probably the primary one being they've adapted to humans. I call such birds winners. Birds that can't adapt to humans, I call losers.
Yeah.
And John Marsluff, in a 2014 book called Suburdia, ended up with three terms for those birds. Make sure I've got them right. Avoiders, which basically avoid human change conditions, our habitats, our urban and suburban situations. They just can't live in such places. Adapters, which are birds that have become able to adapt to our situations. And then exploiters, a third category of birds that are actually doing a lot better because of humans, because of bird feeders, because of bird houses we provide, because of just all kinds of things we do. That last list is hard. I don't know what the quantification of those three categories is. There's certainly a lot of species in all three categories. And it's interesting to look at them in that way.
So if somebody asked you this broad sweeping question, so have human beings been good for birds, or have human beings been bad for birds? What would you say on that? The answer to that would be?
I wouldn't hesitate. I would say very, very, very bad.
Okay, well, that's a lot of very. So flesh that out a little bit for us. You know, you've pointed out that there are some species here in the Northwest, maybe quite a few, that are doing fine. What's the bad part?
The bad part is habitat loss. Many birds are habitat specialists. They, when you take away their habitat, whether it's an old-growth forest or a riparian stretch of trees or sagebrush out in the Columbia Basin, they have nowhere to live. They're really adapted to those particular habitats, adapted to how they forage in those habitats. They're specialized for being able to find insects in sagebrush or being able to find seeds in grassland. And as we get rid of those habitats, they decline. And there's nothing that they can do about it, or nothing we can do about it except stop getting rid of habitat. The Columbia Basin, I have to mention it because it's, you know, I lived here for a very long time. I loved going to Eastern Washington when I came here. It was so rich in everything. It's of course so very different from Western Washington and Seattle. And I don't know the exact figures, but I think it's pretty much been taken over 90% or more of the habitat there has been lost to agriculture. So we have to eat. We have to eat and say, oh, well, that's, you know, that's our bread basket. We plant all these things that we, because farmers want to get richer and richer, they not only plant enough for North America, for American seed, but they want to export it to Asia and elsewhere in the world. So there will never be an end of turning natural habitats into agriculture. Even if our population stabilized, that still wouldn't change that. So there's pretty much all the Columbia Basin is lost now, except for a couple of preserved areas of sagebrush and sagebrush bird habitat. So those birds are just going to totally disappear. So that, to me, that's the worst situation in Washington, is the Columbia Basin and the sagebrush and grassland there. Forests, we still have a lot of. We've cut most of our old growth forests, but we have some really large national parks that preserve quite a bit of it. Notwithstanding that, spotted owls are going to be gone from Washington in the not distant future. I have a friend who lives in Packwood, who's a spotted owl biologist. He's retired, but he's studied them for decades now. And he knew where all the pairs of spotted owls were in a very large area around Packwood. He can't find any now. He actually took a birder out there who really, really wanted to see a spotted owl, and he could not find one. He actually showed my wife and I spotted owls several times over the last couple of decades, but he can't find any, and he really knows how to find them. So that's just one example.
Yeah. Well, you put your finger on what I think is a key issue, a key question, and that is when it seems like we're so often confronted with a conflict between economic growth, economic prosperity, and taking care of the environment. And of course, as you're pointing out, taking care of the environment is also about taking care of the wildlife that lives there. So what would you say to somebody, a farmer who wants to plow up a field that's never been plowed up before, and he says, you know, I'm going to provide for my family with this, and if there's some birds there, well, they're just going to have to figure it out. Or put a little differently, why as human beings do we care about bird populations?
Well, I guess I'm not a farmer, so of course I'm not faced with that dilemma, and I do understand the farmer's point of view and that it is a dilemma. And I don't know what the answer is, except maybe to control human populations better than we're doing now, to not have constant population growth in our species. If we could stabilize as such, you know, maybe the world itself could stabilize, the environments could stabilize. They're having this big meeting in Canada now, as you probably know, a convention of biological diversity, where they're trying to set up ideas to preserve that biological diversity. Because again, it's not just Washington State, it's or North America, it's all over the world. In some areas, far, far worse off than we are here. We do have a conservation ethic of sorts. We have set up a lot of national parks and other reserves to preserve habitats, which is great. I wish we could preserve a lot more of them, because that's really the answer. There's two answers. Oh, there's probably a lot more, but one is preserve as much habitat as we can of every kind and the animals that are in it, because there's a food chain involved. So if we preserve a habitat but kill all the insects there with pesticides from the nearby farmlands, we're not really doing so much for the birds that eat those insects. So that's, you know, that's amazing. And the other thing, I guess, is to even make our cities and suburbs better for birds, which you know, sometimes people think of that. The Audubon societies and conservation groups do that. Plant more trees, leave more open space, you know, just things like that are helping. And help them,
you know, there's just
by feeding them in the winter. We help them by putting up nest boxes, or, you know, those kinds of things, again, in urban suburban areas where we live.
Yeah, you know, there's some subtleties in life too that I don't think devolve to just simple dollars and cents. And I have a couple feeders in my backyard, and I face a wooded area, and so I get a great deal of joy as an amateur of just observing the birds and their behaviors. I love watching the pecking orders and the fact that you know, it's almost like the telegraph goes out, oh, here comes a bigger bird, we better get out of here. And so isn't there something to be said for that kind of non-financial value of having this beautiful diversity of birds in particular and wildlife in general?
There is so much to be said for it. That's a very important point. No question about it. I have the same thing. I have bird feeders. I love seeing the birds. I think I'm home a lot working on my computer. I think I'd go nuts if I didn't have that wildlife around the house. Mm-hmm. We live at the edge of a big ravine, so we have a lot of birds. And I just see them coming to the feeders and see them coming to bird bath and so forth. And I really appreciate that. And as a scientist and ornithologist, I just enjoy learning even from that, because I'm always learning something. As you said, the peck order, who pecks whom and so forth. And the seasonal changes, you know, we get migrants coming in and then going out again. I love all that. And I think huge numbers of people do love that. So it is, again, we need to consider that. And as people have said, it's not just our enjoying the birds in our yard. It's the whole natural environment that supports us. I mean, how could there be human beings on this earth if we didn't have the natural environment in which we evolved in the first place, with that furnished us all this food, that furnished us this clean water, that furnished us this clean air? The oxygen we breathe, you know, came from plants. We can't get rid of the plants because they're producing the oxygen we breathe. And the water, the wetlands are cleansing our water that we drink, and, you know, all these really, really big, big things, big picture things. And then it gets down to our enjoyment of wildlife, which is a major thing. You go to a national park and see all the cars stopped where the bison are out in the plains and so forth. And clearly people love wildlife. Look at the number of people that watch the nature shows on television. I can't even imagine how many are doing that on a given evening and so forth. That's all very positive. And I think to me, the basic thing is stabilizing our population so we don't have to clear more land. We don't have to cut down more forests. We don't have to catch more fish. You know, the ocean is suffering horribly from overfishing, so many parts of it. And that's, and that goes up the food chain, of course, to birds and marine mammals. Mm-hmm. And so they're declining for the same reason.
So I'm just thinking about a situation I had the opportunity to see recently. One of my friends had downsized and moved from a home into a condo. And it turned out that the condo development prohibited bird feeders. And this person had always enjoyed having a bird feeder out. But I was looking off his balcony, and the condo property ended about 50 feet from where his balcony was. There was a fence, and then there was a tree brushy area. And the residents in the condo all along the row had put up bird feeders just across the fence. It was really touching that they, and of course, like every 50 feet, there was a bird feeder. So the birds were a little bit of bird heaven there, but it just an example of how important that was to those people and how much joy it brought into their lives.
That's the reason my wife and I will never move into such a place.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm a kindred spirit on that one. I like to think that I'm pretty much rooted in my home with everything that it includes, including those birds that I enjoy so much. So you mentioned seabirds a bit. And of course, we've got lots of shoreline. Last time I looked, the Washington State's got a couple thousand miles of saltwater shoreline. How are the seabirds, or those saltwater oriented birds, how are they doing?
Yeah, well, again, variable. Some are doing very well. Our glaucous-winged gulls, which are our common gull you see everywhere here, are doing just fine. And large gulls all over the world are doing fine because they're very well adapted to humans. They eat scraps. They nest on our rooftops and our piers and so forth. Double-crested cormorant, for some reason, is an extremely successful species. It's everywhere. It is the most hated bird in North America. I read somewhere that a million of them have been killed now by the Fish and Wildlife, by the wildlife services, which are the part of the government that go after native birds and mammals, which are considered pests. They're considered pests because they come to orchards, because they come to fish hatcheries, because they, you know, they do things that interfere with human endeavors, money-making endeavors in most case. And so they're very, and they, double-crested cormorants, of course, are fish eaters. And they eat commercial fish and they eat sport fish, and they're very common. So there are colonies of hundreds and hundreds of them have just been wiped out by shooting and by destroying the nests. And for some strange reason, they must have human genes in them. They're still increasing, or rat or cockroach or something. You know, amazing how well they've done. But the other cormorants are declining. The loons are all declining. The grebes are all declining. None of the seabirds, other than the two species I named, are actually doing well in Washington. They're almost all declining. And whether it's because, and it's a complicated thing because, of course, birds migrate. So many of them migrate. And so are they declining just in here, or there's something happening to them, to their breeding grounds, that causes us to see fewer of them in Puget Sound? Don't really know the answer to some of those things. But I think there has been overfishing. I think there's no question that climate change probably plays a bigger part in seabirds than in land birds, because climate change has produced some very warm oceans out here, including into Puget Sound, and has really caused a decline of a lot of very important, like the krill, the planktonic organisms that are there, have declined dramatically in some areas. A little seabird called the Cassin's auklet that breeds in colonies on the Washington coast declined precipitously 5 or 6 years ago, and they were finding dead carcasses of them all over the beach. They were just starving to death because they couldn't find food. They eat krill and little shrimp and things like that. And so they were really in trouble. Now, I don't know what their status is now. I think they picked up back a little bit, but that kind of, that was when the blob was off our coast, this warm water blob. And that kind of thing is happening again this year. And so it's, you know, it's hard to know what's going to happen to all these birds. But I've been I live near enough to Edmonds that I've been going out to the Edmonds fishing pier for many years now to photograph birds. It's a wonderful place. There's a lot of birds out there swimming around the pier, flying past and so forth. And those birds have dropped by, I would say, 90% in 15 years.
Wow. That's
they were so common there before. I don't even see them now.
Yeah, that's a truly disturbing observation. And I think one of the things is that for the layperson, it's hard to keep track of this stuff. In other words, that decline occurred over 15 years. And unless somebody's specifically observing that and tracking it, it's difficult to keep up with it. And then we can just lull ourselves into, well, you know, everything is okay. You know, my house is still here and I still have food on my table and so on. So it seems like one of the concepts is that when we interfere with the environment in some way or other, and really all human activity results in interfering with the environment in some way or other, when we interfere, it's really difficult to know what the ramifications of that are going to be, which to me says we need to be really, really careful when we do those interventions in the environment.
We should be more thoughtful. That is for certain. I was going to say something about the... what you were talking about a minute ago is what we call a shifting baseline. So somebody who's just a teenager now and, say, getting into bird watching or something, what they see is what they get. You know, they have no idea whatsoever of what it might have been. And I've taught a lot of bird classes, and I have taught some of this, but I tend to soft pedal it a little bit because I just don't want to make everybody unhappy when I'm giving lectures.
Yeah.
And say, oh, yeah, this species used to be common. And now when 10 years ago when we went out, we would see five of these. Now we don't see any. I don't do too much of that because I don't want to make people depressed, you know, all the time. But I see it myself, and I've lived a long time. And so it's a depressing thing to me, because I love the environment. I love animals. And it's been a really sad thing to me. It's like losing a member of your family or something like that.
Well, that's a key point that I deal with also, and that is that we want to be aware. I like to use the term clear-eyed view. We want to be clear-eyed about what's going on. We don't want to be over pessimistic or optimistic.
Absolutely.
But there is a balance that I search for in terms of saying, look, we have plenty of things to be concerned about, and if we can take appropriate steps, we're going to be able to create a better world. Of course, that's a big if.
Yeah. But I couldn't agree more with you. That's the way I look at it as well. I think we need to understand what's going on. And this meeting in Canada, this Convention of Biological Diversity, that's the sort of thing they're doing. I think they have delegates. I think they have 100 delegates from over 100 countries there. It's just a really big thing. It's like the climate change meeting in Cairo. It's every so many years they have this. And the sad part is they heard them talking about it on the radio, and they said the last such meeting set up 20 goals for the future to try to conserve biodiversity. And there was like a little pause in the commentary and said, and not a single one of them was achieved.
Yeah, that's stunning, disturbing, depressing. And I guess one of my answers is that those of us who care need to keep caring and to put that clear-eyed view out there of what's actually going on. So one of the things that is pretty clear that climate change is influencing here in the Pacific Northwest is the incidence of wildfire. The data all up and down the West Coast is pretty clear that the severity, the number of acres burned, the number of fires and so on is increasing over time. So do these wildfires have an impact on bird populations?
Yeah, sure. When they destroy habitat, of course they do. Presumably a lot of birds at least can fly away from fires, unlike snakes and rats and squirrels and marmots and foxes and all the mammals and other things that are killed when these fires go through. It just almost made me weep when I went out to the Columbia Basin and saw an area of huge, huge fire out there that happened this last year. And just knowing all the neat animals that lived out there and the plants. The plants, many of them will come back. They have seeds in the soil that will regenerate. Some of the mammals are able to burrow deeply enough that they can come back. Certainly kills the vast majority of the animals that live there. Birds, a lot of them do fly away, and we don't know where they go or if they can find food or habitat for the future. So they're very serious destroyers of wildlife. And
it's like that would be an example of what I'm talking about, you know, we burn fossil fuels, the earth warms, it increases the incidence of wildfires, which impacts wildlife, including birds, and we don't know where it ends. We like to do conjecture about where it ends, but we don't really know. And we don't know. The key thing we don't know is what are we as a species going to do to stop this decline of so much of our environment? One of the things you did make a reference earlier to insects. So, you know, as a layperson, I think that birds like to eat bugs. So there's a lot of good evidence that the insect population around the world is declining, significantly declining. What's the impact on insect populations versus birds?
Well, I don't know. You've probably heard the term insect apocalypse.
I have.
That's the term they're using. And they've got really good data from Europe showing that an actual quantified from censuses that they've done of various kinds in Europe for years. We've got some of that from North America as well. Just an example, when I was a kid, I lived in Miami. When I was a teenager and a young adult, I got my PhD degree at the University of Miami. And I've always been interested in insects. When I would go to shopping centers and out at the edge of Miami, where it sort of gets near the Everglades, we would just see literally thousands of insects coming into the lights of these shopping centers, big giant water bugs, 2 inches long, flying around and hitting you in the head and they scrape them off you and so forth. It's just, you know, I didn't think there could ever be anything different. Now, when I go to Florida, and I've been back there many times, there are no insects at all at those lights. It's not a case of a lot fewer. There are virtually none. And it's just shocking. And yet the Everglades are still there. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of interesting. There is a lot of habitat still, but the insects are going away. And people have noticed that all over the country. And so that's got to have just a gigantic effect on birds, because the majority of birds are insect eaters.
Yeah, I have an electric car, and my car group, somebody was making the comment the other day that, remember how we used to have bugs all over our windshield? I mean, you go into the service station, you have to spend 5 minutes cleaning the bugs off your windshield. And I just don't see bugs on my windshield anymore, which seems to be a symptom of the same thing you're talking about. And once again, it points up the interrelated nature of a lot of these natural systems, stuff that, and I like your term about baseline. I hadn't thought about that one before, because as the generations come through, our expectations are different. In fact, when you mentioned that concept, I kind of smiled to myself, because I grew up in Southern Oregon, where we used to have beautiful truck farms with incredible vegetables every summer, including tomatoes, and those tomatoes are all gone. I mean, kids these days, I mean, it's like, you kids don't know what a tomato tastes like.
Yeah, really.
So,
yeah, there's a British author and naturalist wrote a book, The Moth Snowstorm. And he wrote it, this was like 10 years ago or so, he wrote about the very same thing, driving through the British countryside as a kid and literally having to stop and clean the moth and other insects off the windshield. And I can relate to that too. And not anymore. And people in this country have remarked on it in various parts of the country as well.
So we're getting close to the end here. So I'm just going to ask you a big picture question. If you could sketch out for us your point of view on where we are with birds in general and what that means for us as human beings.
Boy, that's a big one. We have to stop it. We have to stop destroying habitats. We have to lay off the pesticides, have to start doing agriculture in a much more planet-friendly way, I guess I could say. And that would be a major thing, because in the Columbia Basin, not only is the sagebrush greatly declined, but the little patches of it are all next to farmland where they actually, where every time the wind blows, they get pesticides blown right into them because there's pesticides applied everywhere. We've got to start keeping our cats inside. Cats are responsible for more bird deaths in North America than anything else, except possibly windows. Been a lot of data on those things. And cats may kill as many as a billion birds a year in North America. And that's, I love cats. I've had pet cats, but they got to keep them inside. I don't know, you know, what can you say? Population control is number one in mine, because every human that's added is a little bit of a detractor for the environment, especially with the present day. Now, as you say, we need to work on climate change. We need to have electric cars. There's so many things we could do to mitigate climate change. We're not doing them fast enough. That's a major thing we got to think about. And just preserving habitats, I think, is probably a really, really big one. Preserving habitats, using less pesticide. If we don't do those things, yeah, birds are just going to continue to decline. House sparrows and starlings are declining in Seattle. Who would have ever thought that? You know, these two introduced, quote, pest birds, unquote, they're declining even.
Yeah. So those are some, I think, really valid macro points that we, as a political system, we need to be working towards to improving in all of those areas. So for myself and for listeners who are just individuals, what message would you give to us about birds?
Well, if you feed them in your yard, if you can, it helps them. Don't plant native vegetation, which often supports insects that are native to the area. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, and that some of the introduced rhododendrons are terrible. I love rhododendrons visually, but they are plants that produce chemicals that deter insects. Wow. So they don't have insects on them. Mm-hmm. So you find a big bunch of rhododendrons around your yard, you're not going to have any bugs for the birds to feed on. So plant native plants, plant fruit-bearing plants, which robins and cedar waxwings and other things will actually come to and eat. Put water sources on your land. We have this November, we had sort of a drought. We never could imagine such a dry, warm, early November. And some of our plants started wilting, you know, it's pretty obvious. So these kinds of things are things individuals could vote for environmentalists, support environmental organizations. You know, these kinds of things I think are very important.
Well, that seems like great advice. And we have show notes for this program that people can refer to online stuff. So I'll put a link on to Washington Audubon so people can go there if they're not already members of Audubon or followers of Audubon. Sure. And any other resources that we could add to that list?
The Nature Conservancy, which is so important in saving habitats, I would say.
Great.
That'd be a major one, yeah.
All right. Well, we'll do that one too. I've been a supporter of Nature Conservancy for a long time. It's an interesting intersection between private funding and public good, and I've really admired them because of that in particular.
Absolutely.
So, Dennis, it's been instructive to get your really scientific perspective on what's going on with birds in our population and what we need to do to defend them and why we should. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Don, it's my pleasure. That's for sure. And let's hear it. Let's have hope for the birds. Okay.
Okay. I'm with you there. So here's hoping for the birds. And I'm sure that listeners share that view. So once again, thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
So many thanks to Dr. Paulson for taking the time to talk with us. We've got a long history here in the Pacific Northwest, as well as around the world, of putting money ahead of our environment. In a strange way, it's worked for some folks over the last couple of hundred years, but the model is untenable longer term. The loss of species and our unremitting degradation of our environment can't last forever. The plight of birds are both here at home and around the world, just like the canary in the coal mine, as giving us a lesson that we shouldn't ignore. And the truly ironic thing is that if we continue to put money ahead of our environment, someday the financial chickens will come home to roost and will be paying the price then. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out. A bunch of good people. Join up or find another organization if you aren't already attached to join your voice with others. This program, along with all the other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under programming. So until we talk again, remember that all great victories were almost great defeats, and always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.